WSOR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Reese Helmick with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, July 23rd. Neighbors sent New College of Florida a letter of concern with 70 signatures of residents. In it, the Uplands residents raised concerns about the college's updated campus master plan and its potential impacts on their neighborhood. Karen Stack, who owns a home in the Uplands, says residents feel shut out of the planning process. Among their concerns is inadequate public notice, lack of outreach to neighbors, poor communication, a substandard presentation at a previous public meeting, and conflicting information from officials. A next-gen federal database designed to predict extreme rainfall that leads to floods may be safe from federal budget cuts. A scientist working on the NOAA-funded Atlas 15 project planned to modernize the nation's rainfall data was told to expect to resume work on the project, but is still awaiting the green light. Modernization of the database was commissioned during the Biden administration and funded by the bipartisan infrastructure law, but came under scrutiny when Trump took over the office. Civil engineers and floodplain managers say the nation's current rainfall atlas is outdated, making infrastructure vulnerable to flooding. The Association of State Floodplain Managers has campaigned for the completion of Atlas 15, as originally scheduled for this fall and next year. The Gulf Coast Community Foundation released an update of its water quality playbook. Recent achievements highlighted by the playbook include establishing Bobby Jones Nature Park, 20 acres of wetlands that filter 900 pounds of nitrogen a year, the ongoing rewilding of the quad parcels near the celery fields, and an update of Sarasota County's biggest wastewater treatment facility. According to a Sarasota spokeswoman, the Bee Ridge facility will begin advanced wastewater treatment by the end of the year. Next on the list of improvements is the Venice Gardens Water Treatment Plan. Upgrades on Venice Garden were made in May. This will be followed by the Central County Treatment Plan. Seagrass, essential for marine wildlife, has been expanding. The biennial map of Sarasota Bay's seagrass meadows shows that from 2022 to 2024, there has been a 19% increase of seagrass. This has been Reese Helmick with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, July 23rd.
And welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. My name is Tom Walker. This is every other week I have this show, and Bob Connors has the other Wednesday. And remember that the views and opinions expressed by the hosts and the guests or the callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. We have a great guest today. His name is Michael O'Hanlon. Michael is the Brookings Institute Director of Research in their Foreign Policy Program, where he specializes in the U.S. defense strategy and budgets, also in the use of military force and the American national security policy. He holds the Phil Knight Chair in Defense and Strategy there at Brookings. He's an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and Columbia University. He was a member of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board from 2021 to 2025. And he was also a member of the External Advisory Board at the CIA from 2011 to 2012. His latest book, which we'll talk about, is Military History for the Modern Strategist, America's Major Wars Since 1861. Michael's other books, by the way, are The Art of War in an Age of Peace, U.S. Grand Strategy and Resolute Restraint, Defense 101, Understanding the Military of Today and Tomorrow, the Senkaku Paradox, Risking Great Power War Over Limited Stakes. The Senkaku Islands are small islands off the coast of China that are in dispute. Beyond NATO, a new security in architecture for Eastern Europe. The future of land warfare, strategic reassurance and resolve, U.S.-China relations in the 21st century. And we'll be talking about China, of course. And crisis on the Korean Peninsula. And finally, Winning Ugly, NATO's War to Save Kosovo. His recent articles include a detailed analysis of the U.S. defense budget, a military assessment of a possible Chinese blockade of Taiwan, which I hope we'll talk about, and a proposal with Georgetown professor Lee Howard for a new security architecture for Eastern Europe. And we'll talk about that, too. Michael has appeared. This is amazing. Michael has appeared on television or spoken on the radio more than 4,000 times since September 11th, 2001. Well, that's amazing right there. But I know why, because he's such a clear and concise explainer, and he has so much experience that people love to have him on, and we're very lucky to have him. He was an analyst at the Congressional Budget Office from 89 to 94, and his doctorate from Princeton is in public and international affairs. His bachelor's and master's degrees from Princeton are also in the physical sciences. He served as a Peace Corps volunteer. This is interesting. Peace Corps volunteer in the Democratic Republic of Congo from 82 to 84, where he taught college and high school physics in French. Earlier, he worked on a dairy farm in upstate New York, where he grew up. So during college, he attempted unsuccessfully to disprove, with Princeton experimental physicists in the gravity group, to disprove Einstein's general theory of relativity, which didn't happen. Very interesting. My son and grandson went to Princeton. That's a great school. His forthcoming book is To Dare Mighty Things, U.S. Defense Strategy Since the Revolution. So welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
I heard you speak at the Sarasota World Affairs Council here in Sarasota last year. Your speaking and writing is some of the best and clearest I've ever experienced. And I recently just resubscribed to Foreign Affairs Magazine in order to make sure I could still read your essays. Today, as I told you, I'd like to tap your knowledge all around the world, go around the world surveying the hotspots and getting your short takes on each one and what problems are there and what may lie in the future. And perhaps we could start with Israel and Iran. Will they draw us further into the conflict? And why has Iran not struck U.S. shipping or bases? A lot of questions there. What do you think? What's your take on that?
Hi, Tom. Well, I think that the first thing to say is that in this very polarized and contentious world we live in, especially of American politics, that President Trump's decisions were, in this case, reasonable. There are a lot of things about Trump's foreign policy I don't like. You know, the claims on Greenland and Canada, for example, and the disdain for allies and the willingness to completely upend the international economic order, it would appear at times. But in regard to Iran, you ultimately give the nod to this decision to use a little more than a dozen of these massive ordnance penetrator bombs to try to complement what Israel is doing and destroy the deep underground Iranian nuclear facilities. Whether you agree with that or not, it was carefully and studiously considered, and I think the outcome was probably pretty good, although this is not over yet. And so I have no beef with how the president went about the decision-making. I think he understood his options. I think he reassessed each day whether it made sense at a given moment based on potential negotiations with Iran to perhaps verifiably rein in Iran's nuclear weapons program, or whether it was studying where the Israeli air campaign was and whether we could usefully complement that with weapons we have that Israel doesn't. So that's the main point I would make. But the other main point I would make on Iran is that, again, this is nowhere near over. We don't really know how much damage was done to the Iranian nuclear program, but even if the damage was quite extensive, as it appears likely to have been, Iran will probably try to reconstitute and rebuild and not allow inspectors in this time. So I think we're going to have to face the distinct possibility of either an Iranian nuclear weapon in 5 or 10 years or the potential need to go in and do this sort of air operation again. And next time we may not know as well as we did this time exactly where the Iranian nuclear facilities are located. So again, on an interim basis, looks like a reasonable decision and perhaps a decent outcome, but it's not the last chapter.
Right. It doesn't look like Iran wants a larger war. They haven't struck U.S. shipping in a significant way, right? And they did give a warning to that one attack on a U.S. base, I believe. So they're being careful as well. How about Israel and Palestine and Gaza and the West Bank? Do you have any thoughts on that? What's their goal in Gaza, do you think? And we've had shows on Gaza here before, of course. And most of my friends call it an ongoing genocide. But what is your take on Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank?
Yeah, Tom. Well, I don't call it an ongoing genocide because genocide is deliberate and it seeks to exterminate a population. Mm-hmm. Israel's tactics, in my mind, have been at times extremely callous, but not deliberately murderous.
Okay.
Except towards Hamas. And let me say I'm 90% behind Israel, but the 10% where I disagree is important because Israel had a right to retaliate and to change the rules of the game after October 7th, 2023. What happened that day was so heinous, and it's easy to forget because it's now 2 years ago, but more than 1,000 innocent, unarmed Israeli civilians, many of them attending a peace concert, were murdered, mowed down in a deliberate attack that Hamas's leadership had planned over an extensive period of time, with the complete disregard for human life that attack demonstrated, as well as the clear political goal of preventing any kind of peace process, any kind of rapprochement, whether between Israel and Palestinian Authority in the West Bank or Israel and Saudi Arabia, which is something that was budding at that moment. And so Israel had to respond and respond very forcefully. And I don't think Israel could have been expected to do any future deal with Hamas, even a ceasefire deal that lasted for long, because Hamas completely invalidated itself, if there was any doubt left, as to whether it could be seen as a responsible, serious political player. So that's my full stop endorsement of Israel's right to retaliate. However, I think that Israel has sometimes used weapons that were too big. The way it killed the Hamas leader was splendid. Maybe not the right word to use when talking about even killing a very evil human being, but very careful reconnaissance and a targeted attack. But they've also used 2,000-pound bombs in urban settings where the likelihood of civilian casualties was nearly 100%. And I just can't endorse that. There are smaller bombs. There are ways to also acknowledge that you're not going to find each and every last Hamas foot soldier. Just as we learned after 9/11, you can't kill every Al-Qaeda. So what you have to do is destroy the leadership, destroy the network, destroy the weaponry, and then try to lay out a political vision that tries to dissuade people from joining in the future. That's essentially what we tried with Al-Qaeda. That's what Israel should have been doing with Hamas. And they only got the fist part right. They forgot the velvet glove. They also ignored the need for a political vision and political future for the Palestinian people that would someday involve a Palestinian state. Even if that would be supervised under Israel's security watch, that's okay, as long as the Palestinian people have the hope of a future Palestinian state. The Israeli government has walked away from any commitment to that long-standing international goal. And for that lack of serious political future, I cannot endorse what they've been doing. So again, I'm 90% behind them in the sense that I fully support their need to retaliate and to exterminate as much of the top part of Hamas as they possibly could. But they've gone too far. And the more recent tragedies with aid distribution being so difficult and often lethal for Palestinian citizens is simply unacceptable. And Israel should know it.
I disagree with cutting off all water, of course, and bombing hospitals. And what disturbs me sometimes is children with gunshot wounds to the head. I think they get a little too, I don't know what you call it, but that's murder if they're children. But let's leave that aside. In terms of foreign aid, should we or why do we give Israel $4 billion a year in military aid? Are they a poor country? Are they not to have their own industries? So what's the deal there?
Well, they're a badly outnumbered country in terms of the number of historical rivals and enemies around their perimeter, as we all know. But I think we should be willing to threaten a cutoff or reduction of aid if they don't have a dialogue with us about better tactics or suppressing Hamas, destroying Hamas, and also a political window or future for the Palestinian people. And if we can't get them to engage with us in dialogue where they are willing to modify their views on those two big issues, then I would do what the first President Bush did and scale back at least some elements of the aid package, if nothing else, in symbolic disagreement, even if it doesn't change their behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, I still want to be Israel's friend. I don't like Prime Minister Netanyahu. I think he's been duplicitous, not just in this conflict, but in his longstanding lip service to the idea of negotiations with the Palestinians, when I think we know full well he's never had any serious interest in a Palestinian state. So I don't like him, I have to say, just to be blunt, but I still think Israel is a friend of the United States. And so what I would do is use that aid as an attempt at leverage. And yes, whether it worked or not, at least we stand on principle.
Yes. Okay. Let's talk about another trouble spot, the war in Ukraine. Will Putin keep grinding away at it? And why does he think it's worth it? Why is Ukraine not allowed to strike Moscow? Or maybe that's not true. And they have drones that can go far inland. And then I want to talk about your Ukraine and Atlantic Asian Security Committee you talked about in one of your pieces. But what about Ukraine? What do you see there and predict there?
Well, first of all, as you say, Tom, they can strike Moscow, and they have, but they use their own weapons to do that, the long-range drones they've built, and we have prohibited them from using American-made weapons. And so, as you say, that's, again, in the news as to whether we should relax that policy. But I think the number one key for having a greater hope for peace is to increase overall pressure on Vladimir Putin, not just occasional attacks perhaps in his big cities, but financial pressure and military commitment and resolve in support of Ukraine. So I've been writing recently that there are about four things I believe we need to do that we haven't yet done. I commend President Trump for at least recognizing that Putin's the perpetrator here. He was the aggressor, and he's also the impediment to a ceasefire. So Trump's come along on that, but he still hasn't put enough pressure on. So I think we need a new aid package passed by the Congress for Ukraine. Doesn't have to be as big as last year's, because I understand the MAGA wing of the Republican Party wants this to be primarily Europe's problem and responsibility, but we still need to have Ukraine's back, or Putin's not going to take us seriously, and he's going to think the time is on his side. So 10 to 20 billion in additional American aid. Second, I think the Europeans, who hold about $300 billion in frozen Russian assets in their banks, should start confiscating $10 billion a month and sending it to Ukraine until there is a ceasefire. Because right now, Putin thinks time is on his side. He has the larger population. He has a war-oriented economy that perhaps can keep going better than Ukraine's. And on balance, he thinks that he'll outlast us. He has more patience. He cares more about the issue. And he's elevated it more or less to a holy war in his own mind, which is why he's prepared to see 1,000 Russian casualties a day and keep on going, which is entirely heartless on his part towards his own people as well as the Ukrainian people. But because he's turned this into an historic, great venture of the Russian state, he now likens it to what Peter the Great and Catherine the Great did when they built the Russian Empire in the 18th century, as well as to what the Soviets did in the world, you know, World War II, and what the Russians had done in World War I. And he has elevated his own role in history in his own mind. And Russia's sort of greatness and the importance of this cause for Russia's historical greatness, he's lifted those to such a high level that he thinks it's worth the cost. And again, I cannot believe the callousness of this human being, but that's who we're dealing with. So in addition to the points I've already made, I also believe, as my colleagues at Brookings, Robin Brooks and Ben Harris, have argued, it's possible to toughen sanctions enforcement on Russia, most specifically by coordinating better across major Western countries how we impose this oil price cap. Because as you know, Russia's been allowed to sell oil, but we've been trying to suppress the price to reduce the revenue for Putin. And I think we need to lower the price and then involve more ships in that effort so that Russia doesn't have the ability to find a sort of a shadow fleet of old rusty tankers that it can use without our, you know, prevention to sell oil at a higher price around the world. Mm-hmm. So we've got to stop that. And then the last thing I would contemplate, and this sets up your next question perhaps about the Atlantic Asian security community that Lees Howard and I have proposed. But I think even though Trump has never wanted Ukraine to be in NATO, the NATO alliance, and in fact, historically, I have not wanted that either because I thought it would inevitably provoke Russia. And I thought there were better ways to protect Ukraine. And I think history has borne me out because the NATO idea was just enough to provoke Russia without being enough to protect Ukraine.
Right.
I'm not blaming us morally, but I think it was unwise strategically. But anyhow, Trump could start to say, you know, if Putin really won't be reasonable and he's not prepared to just take the pretty good terms I'm offering right now, where he basically gets to hold on to the part of Ukraine he's already stolen, that's a pretty good deal. And if he won't take that, then maybe I should reassess the idea of Ukraine being in NATO. And maybe it's time to contemplate NATO helping Ukraine protect the 80% of the country it still has, it still controls, and wouldn't have to put us in direct conflict with Russia, because we could make a conditional kind of offer that would just help Ukraine protect its cities from Russian air and drone attack and missile attack. And that could be the sort of the concept or the idea for how Ukraine could join NATO. I'm not really in favor of this as the best outcome, but if Trump were to start hinting at it, it would perhaps put some pressure on Putin to realize the longer this war goes on, there could be downsides for Russia as well.
Hmm. Well, you did talk about instead of NATO on the ground there in Ukraine, you talked about the Ukrainian Atlantic Asian Security Committee with U.S. Explain that a little bit more. U.S. soldiers on more presence on the ground, training and so forth. How would that work?
Well, so we call it the Atlantic Asian Security Community.
Right.
The idea being that it's not NATO, and it could someday include Russia, and it would immediately include Ukraine. And it would be part of a ceasefire, ideally, although okay. you could impose it even as the war continued. But the main goal would be to avoid sort of waving this red flag of NATO in front of Russia, because Russia hates NATO and considers the idea of Ukraine joining NATO to be essentially like, you know, your sibling joining the rival gang across town or something. And it's just for the Russians psychologically too much, even
right.
though I think they exaggerate and even fabricate the idea that NATO could be a military threat to Russia. But, you know, historically, Russia's been attacked from the West a lot, and paranoia is that some people experience. So maybe they really do believe it. In any event, I think there are better ways to try to secure Ukraine. And the idea that Lees Howard and I proposed was to create this community, this Atlantic Asian security community, and we would imagine, as part of a ceasefire, placing a lot of military personnel inside of Ukraine in uniform, but not organized as combat units. They would be observers. They would be trainers. They would help, you know, monitor the ceasefire. They would help train Ukrainians, but they would not be there to fight.
Mm-hmm.
However, if attacked, the expectation would be that Western troops or Western countries would come in to protect their own people. And therefore, you create sort of a dense tripwire effect. But it's not NATO. And someday, as Russia moves beyond Putin, you could imagine bringing Russia into this community as well. So that's the basic idea. To be honest, you know, every month that goes by, the conditions change, the context changes, the appeal of this idea may go up and down. I just think it's a good option to have. Something like this is a good option to have if we get into serious negotiations with Russia. And one of the sticking points becomes the idea of NATO membership for Ukraine.
Mm.
And Russia's adamantly opposed to that, but is willing to contemplate some kind of a different organization that still achieves the effect of helping us protect Ukraine. So that's the idea.
Mm. By the way, we have American troops in Ukraine now, right?
No.
No. Okay.
No,
they're
no we have
advisors.
We had American troops in Ukraine before 2022, and then we pulled them out as we saw the Russian invasion.
Okay.
Starting. I think we still have American diplomats. We still probably have some limited intelligence presence, but we don't have troops.
Okay, so by the way, we're talking to Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution. The future of NATO, then, in your mind, it's expanded far enough east, do you think, or did we move too far east in the past? Is that what triggered Russia? I don't. It has to become stronger, I think. Go ahead.
Yeah, great question. First of all, let me take each one sequentially. First of all, NATO today, 32 countries, including the most recent new members, Sweden and Finland.
Yeah.
Very good security alliance, the most impressive in history. Accounting for 1.4 trillion in total annual military spending, representing about close to half of world GDP. I mean, this is an amazing collection of countries.
Wow.
And I'm strongly in favor of keeping it. And I do think it's defensive in character, even though Putin would claim otherwise, even though the Chinese would claim otherwise. And I think that keeping America anchored to Europe is really important, given what we've seen historically when America was not anchored to Europe and the world wars broke out as a result, or, you know, partly as a result. So that's all that about where we go forward. But in terms of whether we should have doubled its size, because it was only 16 countries at the end of the Cold War, and now it's 32, and included not only much of the former Warsaw Pact, but even some constituent republics of the former Soviet Union, namely Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. I was always skeptical that was smart. Mm-hmm. I do not question the motives of the Western strategists and American leaders who promoted that, including President Clinton and President George W. Bush. Those were the two American presidents who most enthusiastically supported the idea. So it's not a partisan issue in American politics, but I still think it was not ideal. And what we should have tried to do was keep NATO at the original 16, but build something new to add to NATO that, and to add to European security, that would have held out a greater hope of Russia someday being an intrinsic part of it, and basically created a collective security organization where you'd monitor each other's behavior and still promise protection, but not do it under the auspices of an organization created to face down Russia or the Soviet Union during the Cold War. So I was always worried that we were provoking Russia. Again, not in a way that legitimates what Russia has done. I am not blaming us for the war. The war is Putin's.
Yeah.
He's the criminal. He's the perpetrator. He should have known better than to think NATO was a threat to him just because it moved east. We did not put American combat forces further east in the process of doing this. We did not put German combat forces further east all the way up until 2022. And so he should have known that this was a defensive alliance that really was more of an organization about common values and about pan-European security than it was about adversarial relations with Russia. But he invented a pretext and became very vindictive. And starting around 2006-07, he started to really have it in for us. And then the next year is when President Bush convinced other NATO leaders in 2008 to promise Ukraine membership someday, but not to specify when, and not to offer any interim security deal in the meantime. And then we all went and forgot about it. President Obama never thought that was a very top priority, so he didn't spend much time on this issue. And unlike Clinton and Bush, Obama didn't really promote the idea of major additional NATO expansion. I think only two countries joined on his watch, but nonetheless, he didn't do anything to sort of solidify the stability of Eastern Europe. And then, of course, Russia stole Crimea in 2014, and then we've seen what's happened since. So I think that President Bush's idea in 2008 was a poor idea. It's sort of the idea that gives compromise a bad name. Like, sometimes it's actually better to choose one side or the other than to just try to find a middle ground. Because by saying that Ukraine would be in NATO someday, but no timeline and no interim security guarantee, he essentially painted a bullseye on Ukraine's back. Because at that point, Russia's behavior was to some extent predictable. And I say that because I predicted it. I didn't predict an all-out war, but I did write a book in 2017 laying out a different security architecture, similar to what Lise Howard and I later wrote about that you and I just discussed. And I said, you know, if we leave Ukraine in this limbo, good things are not going to happen. Bad things are going to happen. I don't know what they'll be, but this is not a stable place. And I wish I were proven wrong, but unfortunately, I was proven right. And that it wasn't just me. People like Bill Burns, who was CIA director for President Biden, but had been ambassador to Russia during the Bush administration. And Bill Perry, the former Secretary of Defense, Sam Nunn, they were all wary of this idea of just pushing NATO eastward further and further and further and thinking that Russia would understand our motives and accept them. And so people who knew Russia well were quite often warning that this dynamic might not end well. I'm not going to say there was complete consensus. I'm very proud to have been associated with Bill Burns, Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, and some other skeptics of NATO expansion, especially the NATO expansion going as far east as Ukraine and Georgia. But we were in the minority. And as I say, there was a bipartisan majority in favor of NATO expansion that knew that our motives were good and therefore assumed that Russia should understand that as well. Hmm. And their motives were good, but I think they misread Russia. So that's where I've been on this issue for a long time.
Thanks. And by the way, I know you meet with Henry Kissinger once a month. Does he voice any opinions on this kind of thing, or does he mainly sit and listen? I know he's 99 years old.
No, he passed away.
Oh, sorry.
No, he died 2 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Shortly after turning 100.
Oh,
so
I'm so sorry for not knowing that.
Well, it's probably some of your listeners may not have known either. So, you know, the old saying, old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And Henry Kissinger never even faded away. He was going strong the last year of his life. In fact, one of the most memorable things in my entire Washington career will always be listening to him in September of 2023 describe his visit to China that summer, the year that he turned 100. He went to China and they fasted and feted him and recreated the same menu for lunch that they had offered him in 1971 on his first trip there as part of the Nixon-Kissinger opening to China. And he regaled us with these stories. It was unbelievable. And, you know, here's living history to watch this guy in action. I felt like Abraham Lincoln was going to walk into the room next. You know, I mean, it was just uncanny. And we were not such good friends that I would claim we met every month, but I got to know him pretty well. And I would see him every 3 months on this Pentagon advisory board.
Okay.
That, again, he stayed on right up until the last fall of his life. The session that I just described, that was his last one, because the next one after that, it met in December. And by that point, he had just passed away.
We're talking to Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution. Well, we just mentioned China. Perhaps you could talk about China and then Taiwan. And what's your take on the current situation? For instance, will it ever offer aid to Russia? Their army is about the size of ours now. Could you give us an overview of the situation with China?
Yeah, sure. And it's a good place to pick up the Kissinger conversation, because he always had a lot of respect for China. Mm-hmm. He still thought that we militarily needed to prepare for the possibility of conflict and that we needed to stay true and loyal to Taiwan, the small country off China's coast that, of course, China claims. And actually, we don't even call it a country. We don't have diplomatic relations with it. And we don't want it to claim independence, because that would surely provoke China and probably cause the very war that we're trying to deter. But this is probably the single most dangerous thing in the world today, the unresolved status of Taiwan.
Yes.
And so I think that Kissinger didn't think we should ever ignore China's weaknesses and failings and, you know, human rights violations. But he thought that we should discuss those in the context of a respect for a great civilization and a respect for a country and a communist party, for that matter, that had lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty in the last few decades and therefore deserved a certain amount of respect, even as we resolutely and firmly disagreed with China where we had to. And that's an attitude that I've tried to adopt in my writings and my thinking on China. So even as we need to, I think, continue to improve our ability to handle various military scenarios that could arise over Taiwan in particular, we need to really try to avoid that war. And we need to maintain a workmanlike rapport with China that may not be friendly per se at this moment, but that is at least businesslike and respectful. So I don't know that that guarantees peace, but I think it's better than some of the demonization of China that we see in some quarters in the United States today.
Well, we're talking to Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution. So I realize we don't recognize Taiwan, but should we protect it? Is it worth starting World War III? And how would we defeat a blockade and so forth? It's worrisome there. What will China do you think, in the near future?
Yeah. The question of whether it's worth World War III is a really good way to put it, Tom, because when you frame it that way, it's pretty hard to say that the answer is yes. I mean, is it really worth Taiwan and the Taiwan people? They live a pretty good life right now. I've been there several times.
I've been there. I went there on my honeymoon.
Yeah, good for you. And it was, I don't know when you were married, but it was probably a little different place then. And it's been a wonderful place for a long time. I'm sure we can agree. My first visit was not until about 2012. I went with former Deputy Secretary of State Kurt Campbell and a delegation that he took unofficially at that time, because we don't have official delegations except with Congress and then low-level executive branch people, because we're trying to maintain this notion that we're not engaged in normal diplomatic relations. But what Taiwan's got now is good. They're prosperous, they're autonomous, and they're safe. The question is it really worth risking World War III to give them the right to try to pursue even more autonomy? I would say no. I would say to Taiwan friends, please appreciate you've got 95% of what you could realistically aspire to, and the other 8 billion of us who live on this planet don't need to run the risk of U.S.-China war in order, with the potential for catastrophe beyond the levels of World War II, in order to preserve your aspirational rights to even more autonomy. I hope Taiwan friends get that. I think most of them do. And if Taiwan were to do something egregious that provoked China, then I don't know that the United States should come to their defense. And, you know, some people would say, well, what's so egregious about declaring independence? Well, if you know the history, you know why that's egregious. It's maybe not egregious in the sense of morally wrong, but it's so highly provocative and incendiary that it would be foolish, and not just foolish, but almost reckless and frankly callous towards the rest of us, the other 8 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mean to be too hard on Taiwan friends, because it's a fantastic place and a really admirable society. But we don't have any easy option here, Tom, that guarantees peace no matter what. I mean, if we withdrew any potential help that we might offer Taiwan in a crisis or conflict, I think that would increase the risks of war.
Mm-hmm.
And then if and when China did attack Taiwan, I think it's possible that we would change our mind and go in and help them. So I don't think there's any easy way out of this that's guaranteed to be safe. Therefore, I prefer to stay with the status quo and encourage creative political thinking, that it would be better to have people in Taiwan and China do rather than Americans, although I may occasionally pick up the pen myself, but maybe they can come up with some kind of a commonwealth concept for a greater China, where Taiwan keeps all the autonomy it has now, but still acknowledges that in some sense, the center of Chinese civilization is Beijing.
Yeah.
Maybe that's enough. Maybe that's enough for the Chinese to say that they've achieved reunification. I mean, again, it's not really on me. I don't know that the Chinese friends or Taiwan friends want Americans to be proposing a formula, but I think we should keep the peace until that kind of a formulation emerges. That should be the way to handle it from an American strategy and policy point of view, in my judgment. I think that's the safest way. Other ways, even if they might superficially seem safer, like withdrawing any and all potential support to Taiwan preemptively, I think actually would be more dangerous.
Yes. Well, I hope they remain in the calm way they are existing now. They're very successful, and I don't see anything wrong with what they have now. What about let's move to another continent, Africa. We don't hear too much about Africa, but I know it's a growing population. Any thoughts? We have troops there, here and there. What is our? Do we pay enough attention to it for one thing? Are we neglecting to invest like China is? What is our current position on Africa?
Well, it's 54 countries, We don't have a single position. You're right that we do have troops, but I think only about 6,000 on the entire continent.
Okay,
mostly in advisory and training operations. The only sort of operational units that I'm aware of right now, I think, are in Djibouti. And, you know, they're partly dealing with Red Sea kind of security issues as opposed to Africa per se, but also Somalia and other hotspots in that region. But, you know, I was, as you say, Peace Corps volunteer in Congo, formerly known as Zaire. Congo and Rwanda just signed a deal to try to improve security on their border in the east of Congo. And we'll see if that sticks. I hope it will. I'm not sure it will. There's a long ways to go on that front. And the good news is that in Africa today, you do have roughly a third of all the countries, of those 54 countries, that are making substantial headway towards democracy. And also roughly a third that have had pretty good economic growth rates in the last 1 to 2 decades. So there's a lot of hope in Africa, even though there's also still a lot of suffering and misery and conflict. And of course, now I have to say, President Trump's made it worse by essentially dismantling the Agency for International Development under Doge and Elon Musk and cutting off a lot of the medicines that have been keeping Africans alive with either HIV/AIDS or people fighting malaria. Other kinds of basic medications that I just think the American people are too good of a people to just decide to cut off that kind of thing. And in fact, I'm going to be hard on Elon Musk. You know, he's a South African.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't show any American heart by this Doge concept. I think Doge was a bad idea in general because organizational reforms should not start by eliminating the youngest, hungriest workforce. And that's what he did across the government. But in particular, with the dismantlement of AID, they cut off millions of people's supplies of medications. And that's a travesty. So President Trump has made policy towards Africa worse, and he should own that, and he should change it and go back, acknowledge the mistake, and get those medications flowing again, as well as some of the other relief and humanitarian efforts that we carry out in Africa. But the good news is that a number of African countries are starting to get it in terms of governing themselves better and moving towards democracy. And that's a hopeful sign for the future.
I wonder if a quote from your last book said, "The likelihood of foolish and unnecessary decisions to choose war as an instrument of policy often grows when leaders are not thoughtful students of history." And I immediately thought of Trump. You want to comment on that or leave it there?
Well, you know, let me start because I realize Trump bashing doesn't do much good anymore. And I was prepared to, you know, get into deeper explanations of why I thought he was a poor choice for president before the election, because then we were making our decisions. Now that he is president, I think we have to try to work with this administration to some extent. And there are issues where I've written about how I think some of Trump's instincts could be used to the good, for example, on Ukraine. But, you know, on the overall issue of just how to think about this president, I feel that, right, he's not a student of history. He's very clever tactically. And I think Democrats or other critics of President Trump should acknowledge he's a smart guy. So, you know, I don't want to be contemptuous of his intellect, but I like the way you put it, that he doesn't seem to be reflective about history. And, you know, he trusts his gut too much to just sort of maneuver day by day on issues. And sometimes that can work, but a broader perspective is also sometimes needed. One thing, I'll finish this by saying one thing in his further defense. I do believe that despite his willingness to engage in bellicosity verbally, including in the last 24 hours where he's after President Obama and President Biden and Secretary Clinton in ways that I think are outrageous and unfounded, he does seem to dislike physical violence and is reluctant to engage in conflict. He's been critical of the wars of recent times the United States has fought, including those associated with his own party and George W. Bush. And he's been reluctant to get too deeply involved in the Iran operation. And in his first term, when Iran shot down an American reconnaissance drone, Trump chose not to retaliate by shooting down a manned Iranian aircraft because he didn't want to kill the people on board. And so I sort of like the fact that he seems to have a reluctance to engage in physical violence, not a complete prohibition against that. Of course, he did authorize the final destruction of ISIS in a policy and mission that President Obama had started in his first term. And then he also authorized the killing of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian terrorist mastermind, in 2020. And then more recently, of course, the strikes on Iran's nuclear facility. So Trump is not a complete peacenik, but he's reluctant to engage in large-scale warfare, and I'll give him credit for that.
You testified, I think, before Congress about the future of warfare, and your recent book is also called Military History for the Modern Strategist. You've got thoughts on wars and the future of warfare. Could you elaborate a little bit more about your book? I know it's history, for one thing, and then what do you think about wars in general? I know they're, I think you say they're quite often too considered to be fast and easy, but they're never that way. Talk about a little bit about war in general.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Well, I wrote the book because I had always wanted to read this book in the sense that, you know, I've had my whole career in security studies, and I went to graduate school in security studies in the 1980s. And I was sort of stunned that I had gotten through this whole education with a PhD from Princeton and this whole career, 30 plus years in Washington, without really knowing military history, and particularly American military history, as well as I thought I should. And I, over the years, got to have a number of friends in the military in uniform, including some famous ones like General Petraeus, who knew the history better than I did. And I was thinking, how can that be? Because they're out there actually doing things every day, training and fighting, and I'm the scholar in the ivory tower, supposedly, and yet I don't know the stuff as well as they do. And maybe it was partly my different set of interests. I didn't go into the military, and I don't really relish those 800-page books that get into one leader or one battle. I'm not that much of a junkie on military history, but I wanted to understand the big picture strategies and the major flows of events in the various wars the United States has fought, partly to have lessons for future war about different kinds of concepts that work and don't work. You know, some of the warnings of things from the past. At one level, as you say, people often go into war thinking it's going to be a lot easier than it proves to be. That's certainly one big lesson. But also there are certain kinds of things they often tend to do within wars that may succeed better than others. And so I wanted to understand, you know, Grant versus McClellan in Civil War, for example, or the various preparations for the landings in France in World War II and the island hopping campaigns of the Pacific. And then what we got wrong in Vietnam and you know, to some extent, Korea, Iraq, Afghanistan, and hopefully with an eye towards avoiding those kinds of mistakes in the future. So I wrote a book. It's, you know, moderately dense, as you know, because you've been trying to make your way through it. Thank you for that. But it's also just 400 pages for all of America's major wars throughout the entire 250 years.
Good summary, good overview.
And so, but it's not meant to be sort of a TikTok summary of each and every thing. It's those kinds of chronologies I find relatively uninteresting myself. It's meant to sort of stitch together the different battles and events into broader stories. So, for example, in the Civil War, I talk about 7 or 8 major campaigns, series of events and battles over a certain time period and certain geography where one is closely linked to the next, and you have to understand them as a whole. And the best maybe single example out of that for the Civil War would be once General Grant was overall commander of Union forces and General Meade was the commander of the Army of the Potomac, and they devised the concept beginning in the spring of 1864 that would ultimately lead to essentially the encirclement and destruction of Lee's armies and the surrender at Appomattox the following spring in April of 1865. And that was a series of battles where Grant and Meade knew exactly what they were doing, and each next battle followed from the previous one. So you didn't really want to study those battles by themselves. You wanted to understand them as part of a year-long story and a year-long effort, because Grant and Meade were basically losing every battle in the sense that the Confederates were often suffering fewer losses. But Grant and Meade knew they had the numbers, and if they kept at it, they would win and finally end this terrible, tragic conflict that produced as many casualties in 4 years as we've had in all the rest of our military history combined. And so that, to me, was the level of military history I wanted to study and understand, and that's what I tried to convey in the book.
Well, you certainly – I only read the introduction, but even in that, in your introduction – preface, you give an overview of the Revolutionary War, American Revolutionary War, and its 4 major campaigns that made it a lot clearer to me. Not that I'm an expert, but it just made sense the way you pieced together those 4 separate campaigns composed of many battles each. So thank you for that overview, because we don't want to study each little tiny battle in detail. Some people do, I'm sure. But I like the overview. I like putting it all together and making sense out of it. We're talking to Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution. We've got about 8 more minutes. I know your next book is called To Dare Mighty Things, U.S. Defense Strategy Since the Revolution. You could talk about that or anything else you like in this last 8 minutes.
Well, thank you, Tom. And yes, I have really had a lot of fun with these last 2 books. And, you know, granted, war is not really supposed to be a fun topic, but it's fascinating. Mm. And it certainly brings out human drama. And when it's all over and you're looking back on it, you know, you can still feel the pain. And of course, you and I have plenty of friends who fought in Vietnam and the more recent wars. So these wars may be over, but they're not really over. Having said that, they're so consequential for history that I relish the chance to just dig in. And so these were sort of my COVID and post-COVID projects. The book we just talked about that focused on America's actual big wars was something I did during COVID shutdown, mm-hmm. largely. And then more recently, after I finished that book, I said, well, this book covered, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 big wars. And that stretches over about 30 some years of American history. What about the other 220 years? What about the periods of relative peace? And what about the evolution of U.S. defense strategy over the entire history of our nation? And what patterns can we see? What big stories can we see? Especially a lot of the 19th century history people don't often know that well. War of 1812, mm-hmm. U.S.-Mexico War, Spanish-American War, all the battles against Native Americans. And I wanted to study U.S. defense strategy and military operations throughout all those periods, and then also the interwar periods of the 20th century. And I had spent a lot of my career, you know, I had sort of lived already the last chapter of that book, which is the post-Cold War world. I arrived in Washington in 1989. That's the year the Cold War ended, the Berlin Wall fell. So my career has essentially been what became the last couple chapters of the book. Mm-hmm. And then when I was in graduate school, I was living and studying the Cold War. So I figured I already had a good starting position in regard to the Cold War, the post-Cold War period up to the present, And then the world wars, which I had already, and Vietnam and Korea, I'd already studied and written about in that previous book you and I just discussed. So I had the idea for this book coming out late this year, but technically with a 2026 copyright from Yale University Press. And it's called, as you said, To Dare Mighty Things, U.S. Defense Strategy Since the Revolution. So the whole 250 years. And I got that title from Theodore Roosevelt. And, you know, the famous speech a lot of people know about that he gave just before becoming president, when he talked about the importance of sort of getting out there and trying and not just shrinking back from the great struggles of the day. And he talked about the importance of daring mighty things. And I'm not the biggest Theodore Roosevelt fan in the world, because I think he wound up in his later years a bit of a edgy guy towards Woodrow Wilson and towards a lot of what we were trying to do at the end of World War One, and then creating a sustainable peace after World War One, which of course we failed to do. And Roosevelt was not much help in that, but he's still a fascinating and admirable figure in many ways. And what I liked about that quote was that it captured for me pretty much the American spirit to dare mighty things, because I do not believe we have always been successful in our wars. And I do not believe we have always been well intentioned in our wars, because the U.S.-Mexico War of 1846 to 1848 was basically a land grab by the United States. Yeah. And the battles against Native Americans were essentially land grabs. And it would be very hard to describe those as noble ventures, but they were mighty ventures in the sense that they reflected the ambition that Americans have had from the get-go to be powerful. First, to make our nation bigger and more powerful, and then to be a bigger player on the world stage. There are two myths that I try to demolish in the book. Maybe I'll finish on this point. Yeah. One myth is that Americans are essentially isolationists, and that we really just want to be left alone in North America to pursue our North American dreams and our paradise over here. And those Europeans would just stop dragging us into their wars, we'd be okay. That's nonsense. We've never been isolationist, because we started as a small swath of colonies along the eastern seaboard that did not even include your state of Florida at the time, of course. Right. And we wound up a continental power from sea to shining sea. And that was not done by sweetness or negotiation. So that was a reflection of American ambition. And therefore, the other point, we're not isolationist. We're also not really peaceful. Now, we've often been a very important force for good in the world wars, the Cold War, I think still today. But we are not peaceful, and we should get out of the habit of telling ourselves that we are, because that reflects a misunderstanding of our own national character. We are highly assertive, and usually that's a good thing, but sometimes it can get us into trouble. We got to know ourselves. Like Sun Tzu said, the great Chinese strategist, you know, you've got to know yourself as well as your enemy if you're going to be successful in matters of war and peace. So it was a lot of fun to write that book, and I hope some of your listeners may decide to check it out.
Well, when it comes out, when will it come out?
January.
I hope you'll come back on the program to talk about it.
Great.
And we've put a link to your current book on our front page. And this is the Peace and Justice Report. Generally, we try to advocate for peace, of course. So any ideas you have in the future on how to continue peace rather than war, and I know that's your hope too, of course. And thank you for your scholarship and your clarity. It's just amazing the way you write. I can't recommend it highly enough. So, and you have plenty of appearances on the web to listen to. So, Michael Hanlon, O'Hanlon, from the Brookings Institution, his latest book is Military History for the Modern Strategist, America's Major Wars Since 1861. And maybe next time we could talk about the future of warfare. It's getting cheaper with the $400 drones in Ukraine and just, as opposed to the big expensive Pentagon weapons. It's a fascinating topic, but I would hope to avoid them altogether. And I know that it's probably your wish too.
So, well, thanks for having me, Tom. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to the next time and wish everybody a great rest of the summer.
Okay. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution. And stay tuned.